she said as Ostap edged away, uncertain of how to disengage graciously.
Of course, he said, bowing. And I thank you for giving us the option to experience the complete set of such a magnificent collection.
Oh, it's not a complete set, the governor said as Ostap turned to depart. He turned back, not quite knowing how to take his leave without causing offence. What makes Endcamp's reaping season so special is that it cannot ever be complete, by definition. Before his death, he took the most popular piece from the set, Glass Shards on a Lakeside, and burned it. A permanent reminder that while the collective entity may endure, despite the loss of its constituent elements, those elements were nonetheless unique and precious, and incapable of being brought back once they had been destroyed. Ostap pursed his lips and nodded. The cleaning servitor bent and retrieved the napkin, then turned and began retracing its steps. As if the removal of the cloth had reminded her of something, the governor's face shifted to an expression of businesslike objectivity, quite apart from the engaged empathy she had shown him. We do share one thing in common, Minister Fominko. Ashel nodded and began walking away. We both have urgent business to tend to before we will be able to rest this evening.
Chapter 9.
Ashel paused to wish Ostap a pleasant remainder to his evening and hurried to follow the porcelain-faced servitor. The automaton walked slowly through the colonnadium, eventually turning off into one of the servants' corridors. It would have been easier to simply open the door next to the tray of napkins and toss the cloth down to the footman's parlour, of course, but servitors had limited cognitive ability and could not override their base directives. In this case, a predetermined location for refuse or soiled cloth. The servants' corridors on this side of the palace were no warmer or more inviting than the ones off the draper's hall. This particular corridor was more shrouded in dust, leading Ashiel to believe her servants rarely had occasion to use it. The servitor finally reached its destination and cast the napkin onto a small but growing pile of rags. She stepped to the side as the servitor turned and returned to the banquet. The pile appeared to indeed be dirty pieces of cloth for laundering. Fortunately, there were only two other serving napkins present, one of which was stained with Kostoki gravy. She prodded the other, which was crusted with some form of glutinous mud. She picked it up by one of the unsoiled corners and sniffed it gingerly. No, not mud. The coppery tang of blood was unmistakable, as was the wretched odour of rotten stone and human offal. Ashiel dropped the cloth, her face growing cold. She forced herself to breathe, to control the racing of her heart. She needed to find Henrik, or Baron. She swiftly retraced her steps through the cobweb-strewn side hall to the colonnadium mechanate. She was just about to call a servant to fetch the group captain and her brother when the folly of that plan hit her. If Tanzeg revealed what he had seen, there would be an investigation, one that she could never talk her way out of. The discovery of Lostrovsky's corpse, murdered by Xenos' hands at her direction, would seal her fate. She paced back and forth between the art pieces, grateful for the lively Kostoki Rigadon being played in the ballroom, which seemed to have drawn nearly all the guests back. Ashel paused and forced a deep breath through her body and recentered her mind. She stared at the muted colours of Endcamp's reaping season and considered her options. The stub of her missing finger pained her as her anxiety grew, and she rubbed it with her thumb as she thought. Tanzeg Venesin had seen too much. Lostrovsky's remains on his shoes proved he'd been through the doorway into the secret rooms of heresy hidden beneath Darkadon. No matter what he had or hadn't seen, he couldn't have failed to notice enough to ensure her execution if he were to make it public. The act of killing Lostrovsky itself was a matter of self-defense, and the minor artifacts in the uppermost room would be unlikely to condemn her. The ritual room of the old Shoke, however, and Jezubiel's oubliette would be a different story. Should her involvement with the monster be discovered,
which it almost certainly would be if Lestrovsky's remains were brought to the attention of the authorities, then there would be absolutely no chance of her maintaining her title, and precious little chance of escaping her predicament alive. There was no way to capture him, not before he made it back to his home, where his danger increased exponentially, as he would be among his own, and there was no telling who he would let know about what had happened. In fact, every second that passed increased the danger of him telling someone else what he knew. There was only one course that remained open to her. No, what was she thinking? It was heresy even to consider consorting with the Xenos again. She berated herself for her weakness. Ashiel knew what she had to do. It might be a greater risk, but she would just have to command the High Service to raid the Venesan Manor and arrest Tanzek. It would be risky and would create political backlash. But if she acted with haste, she could keep a veneer of respectability. She made to go and find Baron and wondered if she should arrange a distraction for Acelia and Arena before issuing the order. The thought of a distraction reminded her of Tanzek's partner and brought Ashiel up short. The poor woman obviously hadn't realised the extent of what Tanzek had been getting her into. Her knowledge of art might have been feigned, but her initial apprehension in Ashiel's presence had seemed genuine. What would become of her if Ashiel did not intervene? Nothing pleasant, she knew. Tanzek might keep the woman alive, for a little while at least, to bolster his own story. If the Venesans intended to move against the Matkissons in the ultimate, however, the woman would be a witness, a liability that had to be extinguished. She doubted the girl would last that long, though. If she was putting herself in the nefarious mindset of a Venesan, then their plans were better served by the companion's death. Once the Venesans went public with their accusations against the governor, the nobles would begin dividing their loyalties. If the only other witness to the Venesans' discovery of evidence of a Xenos killer in the palace were to be then found dead, it would convince a critical mass of the Grevenet beyond a shadow of a doubt as to her guilt. Idanelle wouldn't need to act. An inquisitor wouldn't need to be reached. The lesser noble houses would unanimously support her removal. The military would support her, of course, but the wardens owed their loyalty to the Grevenet, and combined with the standing forces of the noble families, she wouldn't stand a chance, which would leave countless people vulnerable. For a moment, she couldn't help but wonder what her father might have done. He had known about Jezubiel, hadn't he? It seemed almost inconceivable to her that he had not. She could not foresee any situation dire enough that her father would have committed heresy. By the same token, she could not imagine a situation in which Ruprecht would not have done everything in his power to protect people like Marizia and Quilivia from the depredations of the Venesans. Her father had also never been in a situation as dire as her own. That she knew of. She licked her lips, glancing around to make sure there was no one else in the hall with her. "Jezubiel," she whispered. From behind her, she felt a growing chill as the shadows deepened.
"Yes, Your Excellency."
Whatever language the thing spoke, she could discern its mocking tone in her mind. She steeled her gaze. She was no trembling supplicant. She was the commander-in-chief. And whether she understood the mechanism or not, this thing was under her command. Its own thoughts about the arrangement were irrelevant. Ashiel turned, giving the monster an imperious glare. Jezubiel was examining a painted black figure vase, feigning deep interest in the artifact. In the flickering light of the attending hall, she could see it more clearly than she had ever before. Its skin was black, not dark or dusky. No, the thing was a velvety black, whose body looked soft and satiny because it didn't reflect enough light to look hard or slimy. "Did someone other than me enter the labyrinth this evening?" she asked.
"Yes," the creature hissed.
It jerked its head to the side, examining from a different angle the vase's parallel lines of suffering saints being tormented by the mythical skittlings.
Its white hair drifted languidly, lighter or finer than human hair, to float so ethereally. And you just allowed him to leave again. Jezubiel lifted its head from the urn to fix her with a gaze of mock innocence. Its lipless, sinister face spoiled the effect. Nothing with eyes so malevolent could ever have held true innocence. Whatever it was, it had been born in sin.
"I cannot act unbidden," it hissed. "By the ancient pacts between our people, I am bound by the crystal chains. Only with a sacrifice of flesh and blood can I be free to act on your behalf."
"Another finger?" she asked dryly.
"No, Excellency. Your blood and flesh have already been sacrificed."
Light rippled through the pinkish-purple runes on its flesh, as if an unholy heartbeat had quickened.
"It must be another this time."
"I'll not create a cult for you," she said. She would sooner perish than allow that. How long would it be before some enterprising cultist decided they didn't need her? What if someone else lacked the wisdom to deal with a creature as nefarious as Jezubiel? No, that wouldn't do at all. "If you want a legion of followers making sacrifices to you, you'll have to look elsewhere."
"Oh, no,"
Jezubiel said. It crouched low, the hellfire red eyes glaring at her behind the curtain of gauzy white hair.
"Not a willing sacrifice."
It crooked a finger at her in a beckoning motion.
"You are the holder of the covenant. You are the only one who can offer blood and flesh to the darkness."
Jezubiel's head wound to the side like a serpent sniffing the air.
"And your own flesh, of course, has already been offered."
Ashiel frowned. "I see," she said. So this was the creature's game. If she wanted to stop Tanzeg, she would have to take a life. Ashiel turned from the colonnadium, moving through her receiving hall. She could feel Jezubiel's malevolent gaze watching her as the creature flitted from shadow to shadow, following her as she went. The portraits of the past governors were like a judgmental tribunal. They stared down at her from the wall of the receiving hall, their imperious stares condemning the actions she was contemplating. How could she even countenance such a thing? Would Lendalia or Stendos Matkeson have condemned her actions? Cosmos Windover had burned a trader for offering him Xenos goods. How could she walk through the palace he had reigned in and consider such corruption? Ashel's mouth tightened. She could consider it because there was no other option available. The governors upon the walls were dead, their stern gazes nothing but paint, and their judgment existed only in her mind. She could do what had to be done because she was the only person with the power to do so. The governors of the past had built the oubliette that imprisoned Jezubiel. And while she did not know how many of them laid eyes upon the wretched creature, it was a certainty that many of them have had to have known. Jezubiel was not just her secret. It was a secret that had belonged to all of them, stretching back to the time of the reunification. It was a tool that had been kept in waiting until such a time as the palace might need it. Past the receiving hall, deeper into the palace, she walked, not to any specific destination, but rather to stay in motion, as she thought. She walked past the well-lit parts of the palace and into the places where the halls were dim and the shadows fell long across the marble floors. She need not bow to the cruel whims of the creature. There was no requirement to take a life needlessly. There were soldiers in her employ, criminals in the cells of the wardens. Neither option sat well with her. Both would take too long to arrange, and both would involve making someone suffer and die for the fiend's enjoyment. Ashiel stopped as a thought occurred to her. She discounted it almost at once, being too wicked even to consider. But as she walked, it occurred to her again and seemed
less wicked the more she mulled it over. It wasn't as if Jezubiel were going to eat the soul of whomever she killed after all. Surely he upon the throne was more powerful than a loathsome alien, no matter how frightening, and would take the spirits of the pious unto him. Yes, she realised. She began walking more swiftly, now with a firm destination in mind. She did know of a life she could take that would involve inflicting no suffering whatsoever. One that would, in fact, end someone's suffering. Marizia's lie was gnawing at her. When she had accepted Lord Venason's assignment, of course she had known it would involve deception. That was her speciality. But she had assumed the task would be to stir jealousy in an ex-lover, or to act as Tanzeg's collaborator to defraud some other aristocrat. At worst, she thought she'd be distracting one of the high service while her client replaced some artwork with a cunning forgery. Colluding against the Lord Governor herself had not been in the contract. And though she was far from a loyal citizen, she couldn't shake the notion that lying to the Holy Emperor of Mankind's chosen speaker for her planet was a serious transgression. Marizia, who would positively die if any of her peers or clients were to learn that her real name was Thora Reed, named for Saint Sebastian Thor, whose piety and diligence she had spectacularly failed to live up to, according to her mother, was a veteran of the streets. She'd fought off crooks with nothing but a spring blade and her bare hands. She'd defrauded priests and grebs with her deceptive talents. Once, she'd even convinced a particularly dull-witted boat of a fisherman that she was a senior adept of the Administratum. She'd been bold enough to steal from nobles and criminals alike, and smart enough to evade the wrath of all of them so far, even if that sometimes meant racing blind through dark alleys and leaping over flakboard fencing to escape the wardens. So she was no stranger to an underhanded enterprise. She was not, however, comfortable with the scheme she'd become embroiled in at the governor's ball, nor the current traipse through the gloomy streets of Costovium. Lord Venason hadn't told her they'd be walking all the way back to his manor, assuming he was telling her the truth about where they were going, and she was beginning to feel like someone was driving knives into her feet with every step. She'd dressed for a banquet, not a hike, and was starting to lose feeling in her toes. Of course, there was no telling how long the journey was going to take. Tanzeg was used to riding in carriages and had no experience walking the streets of the city, especially its back alleys. They were already wandering far afield of the quickest route back to the Venason Manor.
"I think we might have missed a turn," she said.
Closer to the palace, she hadn't had much to worry about. But the further they moved into Costovium, the more likely they were to run afoul of lowlives who wouldn't be swayed by the power of the Venason name. She knew he was riled the moment she said it. He stopped, and she could almost feel the temperature in the alley plummet. Tanzeg turned to glare at her, his jaw clenched in rage.
"What did you say?"
he said. His words were calm. She knew better, though. She was treading on the thinnest of ice. Her friend Corrine had warned her long ago not to take an appointment with Venason, and for the millionth time she wished she'd listened. She'd seen this kind of maniacal calm before.
"I think one of the streetlights might have been out," she said,
hastily trying to put the blame on someone else.
"You know how inefficient the street workers are."
The lordling stepped closer, his hands balled into angry fists. His nostrils flared, his jaw clenched and unclenched. Marizia knew the Venasans had a reputation for cruelty and violence, but the families of the Grevenet were usually too weak-willed to do their own dirty work. It occurred to her that whatever dark business he had been about in the palace, she was a witness to it, a witness that might need to be silenced in Tenzeg's eyes. This was real, and she had a sudden realization that there was a serious possibility she wasn't going to leave this alley alive.
"You think I don't know where I'm going?" he hissed.
Marizia started edging her hands lower, creeping towards the hidden spring knife in the cuff of her jacket.
"I'm sorry,"
she said, desperate to stay alive. She might be able to outfight Tanzeg, but a murder of the coadjutor's son was the last thing she needed the warden seeking her for.
Sorry, what?
He said, enraged. She thought at first he was trying to intimidate her, or that he might be hysterical on reckoning. But the truth dawned on her that Lord Tanzeg was just unhinged.
Sorry, what?
He screamed. The veins in his neck bulged and saliva flew from his mouth. She was afraid to make a move for her knife lest it provoke him to actually attack her.
Sorry, what? Sorry, what?
With every repetition, he took another threatening step towards her.
I don't understand, she pleaded.
Marizia was a veteran of the streets, but she had never seen anything as frightening as Tanzeg Venason.
He wants you to use his title.
The alley was as silent as the grave, but she could hear the voice nonetheless. Marizia looked around in panic. There was no saviour for her, not in this part of town. The only unknown left was how badly things were about to go for both her and Tanzeg. Tanzeg had abandoned any semblance of sanity. His eyes were wide, his lips drawn back in a feral snarl. Marizia realised she hadn't imagined it. The temperature in the alley had dropped. The air was freezing. Tiny spicules of ice had spread across the cobbles, creeping from the edges of the alley where the shadows were deepest.
He wants you to call him Lord or Baron, or whatever grand laurel he's draped about himself,
the shadows whispered.
He demands you debase yourself with the labours of your own tongue.
Both she and Tanzeg spun, trying to locate the source of the terrifying emanations. She saw it first, a pair of burning red slits that opened directly behind Tanzeg's back.
How pathetic,
the voice hissed, now horrifyingly real. Tanzeg's eyes widened as he heard the physical voice. Marizia could see a ripple of electric violet squiggles across the thing's skin. She was only seeing it because it wanted her to see the end coming. Tanzeg reacted with lightning speed. Marizia had turned away to look at the creature and felt an iron grip on her shoulder from behind. She flipped her spring knife and jammed it at his leg, even as he pushed her forward, thrusting her into the monster's direction.
Take her!
Tanzeg yelled. She tried to right herself, but she was falling, almost horizontal from the force of Tanzeg's shove. She writhed anyway. She would rather snap her own ankle, her own back, before she touched that thing. The impact with the creature never came. She passed through where it had been standing, felt the shadows rushing past her, even felt her hand, dry and so cold, pressed against the small of her back, redirecting her trajectory. And then the shadows around her were empty. When she looked up, Tanzeg was trying to escape. He favoured his right side, however, and Marizia saw a stain of red down the leg of his elegant trousers. She had wounded him with the spring blade, now lying discarded on the cobbles after all. Realising the futility of flight, Lord Venason drew his blade and engaged the creature, which he now saw clearly for the first time. The angular jaw, the mouthless face, the gauzy hair. It was a creature born of nightmares. It was the dark skittling come to life. It flickered in and out of view, vanishing one moment to reappear behind its quarry the next. In its hands, it wielded two weapons, a small sickle no broader than her hip, and a straight, wickedly serrated sabre, both the creamy white of flensed bone. Its broad, flared breeches flapped and pulled like a performer's skirts. A horrendous croaking, clicking sound accompanied its attacks. Tanzeg was no stranger to the blade. He might even have been able to defend himself against a street ganger or two. Still, his attacks came nowhere near the monster. The thing evaded the lord's blade with ease, stepped around Tanzeg's defences to shred the duelling cloak as effortlessly as snipping a flower, and moved away with the footwork of a trained dancer. Marizia realised that the clicking sound wasn't a product of the creature's attack. It was a mocking laugh.
The sudden realization that additional cruelty of knowing the thing was only toying with Tanzeg solidified the horrendous scene, making reality from the nightmare. She screamed. The creature spared a glance her way, and Lord Venaison saw his opening. Tanzeg retreated back, pulled a pistol from the depths of his jacket, and opened fire. He only got a single shot off with the holdout stubber, which slammed into the creature with no apparent effect. The nightmare eyes flared with outraged fury, and its head snapped back towards Tanzeg. Marizia felt her face and head flare with pain. It was as though every injury she'd sustained since she left the ball had been inflicted anew. Blue fire flickered at the creature's claws, and the shadows closed over its body as Tanzeg fired another wild shot. He had no time for a third. The monster appeared again, snapping the flame from its fingers to engulf Tanzeg's hands. The Venaissance heir's agonized wail was beyond anything Marizia had ever heard in her life. Limbed with crystal blue flames, the skin of the noble's hands paled, then dimmed to blue, then blackened and died, all within the space of time it took for her to draw breath for another scream. She tried to stand, but panic stole her balance and she found herself scrambling like a deer on an icy lake.
"You consider yourself a master of torment?"
the nightmare hissed, looming over Tanzeg. The noble knelt on the cobbles, his face contorted in pain, unable to tear his gaze away from the dead, blackened claws at the end of his arms. Marizia had seen frostbitten corpses dug out of alleys during the depths of the winter, but never had she seen such a condition happen so fast.
"Would you trust a vintner who refused to imbibe?"
the creature asked, its hellish gaze snapping up to Marizia. Fixed by its stare, she opened and closed her mouth, not comprehending any answer she could give that would spare her. Fortunately, it required none. The monster lashed Tanzeg's back with the serrated sabre. Marizia was certain it could have severed the lord's spine and ended his pain in a moment if it had wished, but the slash merely sent a fan of blood spraying across the alley.
"Would you trust a chef who would not sample his wares?"
the creature crooned. Tanzeg spun on his knees, his face crazed. Marizia had seen that face before, on cornered rats refusing to die without a final bite. The thing flickered a step, and the little sickle hooked under Tanzeg's arm. Another spray of blood, and the arm dangled uselessly.
"Have you felt the sting of the scourge, the salt-cured leather rendering your flesh to the bone?"
the shadow thing laughed.
"Have you crawled on needles, knelt on grains of rice? Have your limbs been stretched until your bones broke?"
Marizia could do nothing but stare, wide-eyed, as the thing capered above Tanzeg's form, claws slicing down to send up spurts of blood, blades flashing in to gouge and nick the man's flesh.
"Tell me, mighty noble, how can you be a master at giving that which you refuse to receive?"
Distantly, Marizia heard the sound of the cathedral bells tolling the hour. Their rich chime was like a cleansing charm, a purifying call from the throne itself that shook her from her horrified reverie. Suddenly aware of where she was, Marizia reached a hand behind herself to crawl away. The creature moved without moving. One moment it was carving up Tanzeg's back with delicate flicks of its hooked fingers, the next it was standing over her. The features were gaunt and sharp, without any softness or blemish. Up close, the eyes blazed with a fire that was as deep as it was evil. They weren't eyes, they were pits. Every mote of light this thing had stolen was contained in those depths. She could see, as her soul started to fall into that gaze, the truth. Inside this creature, hatred had been compressed, transformed into emotive cold fusion. Its soul was a battery of wickedness, which would fuel the rune-marked shell it wore for a million years if necessary.
"You might want to leave,"
the thing whispered. When it spoke aloud,
its smooth chin split to reveal a hidden, lipless mouth filled with tiny, sharp seed pearl teeth. Its breath smelled like stepping on dung in the depths of winter, full of the certain knowledge that beneath the cold there was the richest of foulness.
I have so many wondrous lessons to share with him.
Marizia scrambled to her feet and ran into the darkness. Ashiel ran a hand over her stomach, smoothing her gown and calming her nerves. She made the sign of the Aquila and turned away from Dranata's bed. Necessity and equivocation had not made her task easier. The other servants had loved Dranata. Her bedchamber had been tended to with the greatest of care. There were a dozen small trinkets, herbal charms affixed with wax seals, meant to evoke the Emperor's blessing, laid on the old woman's dresser. It had been cleaned from top to bottom, removing any speck of dust that might have remained. Ashiel had seldom seen a fire in the palace that had been better tended, allowed to neither burn too hot nor dwindle too far. A sharp rapping at the door failed to rouse any apprehension in her, which she found strange. She'd felt such trepidation as she had come to the servants' quarters that Dranata had occupied for so long. If anyone had rapped on the door a few moments earlier, while she was doing what she had known needed to be done, she would have been filled with panic. Now, however, as the bells rang out from the cathedral, she felt only a sense of relief. She opened the door, not terribly surprised to find Hanrik behind it, a sentiment his own expression didn't echo. "I hadn't realised you were here," he said. Ashiel straightened herself. "One of the servitors delivered a summons," she said. "I came as soon as I heard." Hanrik pushed past her into the room, denial etched across his face. However, the truth before him could not be refuted. Dranata lay peacefully on the bed, eyes closed, her hands folded in the sign of the Aquila across her chest. "No," he breathed, kneeling at her side. "How could this happen?" He looked back at Ashiel angrily. "She was resting comfortably only earlier today." Ashiel shook her head. She wished it could have been anyone else behind that door. She'd known Hanrik had a special connection with Dranata and had planned to break the news to her brother gently. To find out this way, to come expecting to see his friend only to find her gone, was more painful than he deserved. "Her body was weak," she said gently. "The chances of her waking again were never good." She placed a hand on Hanrik's shoulder. "But we made her comfortable, in the end, and allowed her to pass peacefully in her sleep." Hanrik's eyes were cold and distant, staring only at the recumbent form of the old maid and the soft silken pillow her hands rested on. "Yes," he said, his words steeped with numbness. "Taken in her sleep." Chapter 10. A tincture of ephemint and eucalypt sat on the steps to hide the stench. Ashiel panned her luminator around the floor, looking for body parts that had escaped her notice. She spotted an organ near the bottom of the steps and added it to the barrel. She should have disposed of Lostrovsky's body as soon as she realised it was still beneath Darkadon. It had been a foolish mistake to leave it. There was no problem that went away on its own. The newest remnant joined the others with a flop and a squish. The black, rotted flesh was studded with a bone of some kind, but Ashiel couldn't immediately recognise what part of Lostrovsky's body it had come from. Most likely part of his forearm. When she'd started the distasteful task, she tried to focus on the mechanical work, to disassociate the pieces from what they had been. Her mind, it seemed, was incapable of that, and kept reminding her of what she was looking at. After so long, the stench had become unbearable. Ashiel had broken the tincture, scattering the fragrance over the remains and smearing it thickly across her upper lip. The body's rank presence could never be ignored, but it overloaded her senses enough to let her work. She swept the luminator around again, wiping her forehead on the sleeve of her apron. The boots, gloves and apron had all been stolen from Drenata's trunk, as Ashiel didn't think she had anything that would be appropriate for the task in her own wardrobe. She had originally resolved to clean every possible trace of Lostrovsky's presence from the labyrinth, but within an hour her back and knees were screaming in pain, and she quickly revised her plan. There was no way she could make the heretical tomb safe to bring anyone down into anyway. She focused on gathering the body parts. If nothing else, she wouldn't have to tromp through Lostrovsky's stinking carcass every time she came down here.
"It's not all here," she said, staring into the barrel.
There simply weren't enough of the larger bones, even accounting for the profusion of smallest pieces that she couldn't place.
"Of course not,"
Jezubiel's voice came from behind her, as always, but this time she refused to give it the satisfaction of spinning in disorientation.
"Where do you think these came from?"
She spared a glance at the fiend. It was holding its pair of blades aloft. The curved, smooth form of the small sickle she'd seen before, but the long serrated sabre was new. Neither weapon had a handguard, merely leather wrappings around their lowest ends. Ashiel stared at the weapons for a moment before realising that they had been formed from Lostrovsky's bones. No wonder the sabre lacked a handguard. The assassin's femur would have been too small to carve one out.
"How grotesque," she said.
The shredded skirt the creature had been wearing had grown. Newer, darker strips of material had been added, crudely stitched together to form a pair of large, billowy pantaloons. It was decorating itself with the flesh of its victims. Correction, her victims. Whether soldier or specialist, her father had always made it clear to his children that the assets they employed were still their responsibility. Instruments of command, he'd called them, and his lesson had been clear. A commander bore the responsibility for the actions of their instruments. Just as a soldier couldn't blame a murder on his firearm, a commander could not shirk the blame for the actions of their instruments of command. Not that her hands would have been clean even if she had ignored the culpability in the murder of her attempted assassins. Drenata had been beyond help. She knew that. Still, she hadn't realised how long it would take, how long the old woman would fight for breath that the pillow would never let her draw. Limbs that had lain dead and withered in sleep had suddenly come alive again, thrashing weakly against Asiel's weight. In her dreams, she could hear Drenata crying out beneath the pillow. But she was certain that the old woman had been silent at the end.
"The limits of the fine and the melodic have been defined long ago," Jezubiel said. "The only true artistry that remains is in the realm of the grotesque and the profane."
She simply couldn't deny the impact its display had created. One of her tutors had once defined art as a purposeful display that created emotional or intellectual resonance. Tanzeg's murder had indeed resonated across the city. At every winehouse, alehouse, and bordello across Costovium, tale-tellers claimed to have been the first upon the scene, the first to find Tanzeg Venason's remains. No two of them seemed to be able to agree on the method of his execution or display. But these stories never let truth stand in their way, and tales of Tanzeg's flensing, quartering, or dissection continue to be repeated throughout Costovium. "A public display attracts too much attention," she said. "Your exhibitionism does nothing to serve my ends. Since you cannot, or will not, rein it back, I might as well seal this chamber off entirely." She stood and stripped her gloves off, casting them into the barrel. Jezubiel's glittering red eyes stared at her for a moment.
"You have what you want, do you not?"
the creature asked. It seemed genuinely puzzled.
"Your enemies plotted and schemed against you. I could have swept the matriarch's son away, true. I could have wrapped him in my embrace, taken him to the darkness and let the shadows swallow his screams. If I had, would you be the stronger for it?
The creature drew itself forward, its voice a buzzing hiss.
Now she and her house quake in fear of you. You, who leave your slain enemies strewn about the streets, daring any who would challenge you to step forward and wager their life to the deed.
Jezubiel clicked in its throat, and Ashiel realized with a cold shiver that it was being absolutely sincere. It believed with all its dead heart that Tanzeg's brutal murder and dismemberment had been for the best.
Fewer of your subjects will die this way. Even your own blood will look upon your works and despair once he has the measure of the truth.
My own blood? Ashiel's attention snapped back to Jezubiel.
Yes,
the creature whispered.
Your brother, of course. Even now he stares at renderings of your enemy's ravaged figure, marvelling at my creation.
She clamped the lid on top of the bio-barrel. The vacuumizer hissed as it extracted the air inside. Ashiel studied the valve as if monitoring it carefully. She needed to think. She found Henrik in Jordan's old room. He was bent over their older brother's desk. It was an antique roll-top, its sides covered in intricate carvings of ripe fruits, twining vines and leaping fish. In addition to the sheaf of drawers it housed, there was a veritable army of concealed compartments, hideaway shelves and small swinging doors. "I hadn't realised the servants had put you in here," she said. She hadn't set foot into Jordan's room since his death. There was no art or elaborate decorations in her older brother's quarters. Instead, his bedroom had been fitted with floor-to-ceiling shelves throughout. Most were neatly packed with books on law, religion, military history and governance. But many had been given as space for tools, such as sextants, monoculars and astrolabes. It painted the picture of a man who had devoted his life to preparing to rule an entire planet, determined not to be caught unawares by any aspect of his destined career. She wondered if there were any personal interests that Jordan had eschewed in his doomed study for a role he would be cheated out of. Henrik didn't bother to look up. She wondered if his habit of not making eye contact when he was conversing was born from an erosion of social niceties after living with the rough men and women of the Arbites for so long, or if it was a deliberate affectation to aggravate and wrong-foot those he spoke with. Either way, she knew the best course of action was to ignore it. "The staff put me in the guest house initially," said Henrik, "but I asked them to move me after the attempt on your life." He spared her a glance. "And it seemed that my childhood room had been converted for someone else's use. There were paintings of sailing ships all about."
"Metrian," she said. "One of our tutors. She had a fondness for them. I hadn't realised Father gave her your old rooms."
She prided herself on taking more of an interest in the minutiae of the household than other nobles did. How had she not known that her father had renovated Henrik's old quarters? Was it possible she'd gone decades after he'd left without even once going to his old living space to remember him? Or had she seen the changes at some point and then forgotten about them? Both possibilities were disturbing, but neither so disturbing as the uncertainty that she didn't know which was true. There were a handful of data slates on the desktop. A number of books lay beneath them, open to various places. There were even a few loose reports, although Ashiel couldn't make out what they pertained to. "What are you working on?" she asked. Henrik looked up from the desk, finally.
"Judge Idenel asked me to assist with the investigation into Tanzeg's murder," he said.
"I didn't think that was allowed," she said.
"Under normal circumstances, it wouldn't be," said Henrik. "But Idenel has the authority to authorise my involvement anyway."
He cleared his throat.
"The judge felt that my name and background would give me insight into this crime that the wardens might lack."
It took Ashella time to pass that together. The judge doesn't actually want a real investigation, does he? She asked. He just wants a pat answer so he can file the incident away as resolved. And he thinks you're the perfect cat's paw to cover up the murder of your family's rival. She snorted. He might even think he could use this to hold over you at a later point in your career. Henrik's eyes dropped back to the data slate in his hands. He could lie with his face, but his fingers tapping on the edge of the slate betrayed his perturbance. I have no intention of falsifying or throwing an investigation, he said. I cannot lawfully refuse his order to conduct this inquiry, but should I be challenged on the ethics of my conduct, then no one is going to be able to look at the record and say I did anything less than my duty. Ashiel smiled in spite of herself. She knew that her brother's determination was an incredible danger to her. At the same time, it was only his devotion to the ethics of his office which poised his blade over her neck. The scholar could separate him and attempt to re-educate him, but at the end of the day he was still a Matkeson.
You seem quite busy, she said. Did you want the use of a full office?
I'm enjoying working at Jordan's old desk, he said. They all had. The desk had been their grandfather's. Ruprecht had tried to use the monstrosity when he became governor, but the entire thing had been overwhelmed with trivial correspondence, notes, personal books, and the paper effluvia of a century's worth of use. After their mother had given him a new blood-teak desk, imported from Espandor at great expense, for an Ascension Day gift, he had ordered the old governor's desk incinerated. Jordan had intervened, begging their father to allow him to use the desk as his own. The three of them had spent days cleaning it out. She remembered going through each drawer and slide, discovering doodles, economic or legal reports annotated with scrawled profanity, and hidden scraps of notations that offered an insight into the grandfather they'd never known in life. Each note, every confusing piece of correspondence, was like a treasure to them. Ashiel couldn't recall many other times all three of them had been so unified on the same task. As you like. When you get settled in a permanent position, I can have it sent to you, she said. She regretted it immediately. She'd only meant to do something nice for her brother, but his look of disgust was profound. No, he said, regaining his composure. I'd rather it stayed in the family. Of course. He'd helped to clean that desk, helped Jordan and her to restore it. The ancient wooden behemoth might last centuries yet. It was perhaps his only tangible contribution to the Matkeson legacy. How had she thought he would want it removed from Shokan? What a foolish thought. Of course, she said. Would you be kind enough to bring me up to speed? Henrik heaved a great sigh. Currently, I'm still going over the forensic evidence, he said, handing over a data slate. It showed a series of images of the alley where Tanzeg had been found. Henrik had dramatically undersold the gravity of the situation. Tanzeg was on his knees, leaning forward, his arms stretched behind him. Cords, or bindings of some type, stretched away from his wrists to secure him to the nearby walls. His back was bared, not just of clothes, but to the bone. Ashiel realised that the cords that bound Tanzeg were made from his own twisted flesh. Pieces of meat and various organs had been piled into a pyramid before the venison heir, as if he were bowing before a sacrificial altar made from his own body. His head was stretched back, mouth agape as if screaming to the open sky. A spring knife had been embedded into the crown of his head, the somehow unblooded steel gleaming in the flash of the picta. It was as though he had been anointed, not with holy oil or water, but with the blade pressed into his bone. What kind of monster would desecrate a corpse in this fashion? Said Ashiel, to fill the silence. She was suddenly acutely aware of Hanrik's gaze on her as she studied the data slate. Who said he was a corpse? Ashiel felt her gorge rising.
What do you mean?
She whispered. When we found him, Tanzeg Venason was alive. Henrik shook his head when she met his gaze, misinterpreting her sudden panic.
Don't fret, he's gone. He perished before a medicae could arrive.
Ashiel studied the pictures again. Her skin felt cold. There was a growing pit in her stomach. She had thought she was prepared for the consequences of her actions, but this was beyond anything she had anticipated. Do you know what Tanzeg was doing in the servants' corridors? Henrik asked. Ashiel turned away from the data slate to look at her brother again. His eyes were stone. For the briefest of moments, she thought to throw the data slate at him and run. How could she have been such a fool? If Henrik had even the barest glimmer of competence, he had to consider her a suspect in Tanzeg's murder.
You think I had something to do with this?
She snapped. Her anger was entirely hypocritical, but it would suffice. She slammed the data slate onto the desk.
That's ridiculous, Henrik.
Is it? She crossed her arms.
Yes. I don't have anyone in my household. Have never had anyone in my household capable of...
She gestured to the data slate.
Of that. And you know damn well I couldn't have done it myself.
That's right, said Henrik. You were with Dranata while Tanzeg was being murdered. He left the accusation hanging in the air. Ashiel felt a cold fury creep over her. Even as she reeled at the accusation, a coil of guilt tightened in her belly. She was his own blood, and his trust in her should have been absolute.
Dranata was my dearest servant too, she said. Don't think for a second I wouldn't trade anything to have her back.
Henrik's face had gone cold. She recognised that look from when he had confronted Tanzeg the previous evening. Do you know anything? Anything at all about the murder of Tanzeg, the death of Dranata?
No,
she lied.
Nothing beyond what I've told you.
Are you certain? He asked. As a planetary governor, there is a wide latitude given to you. Given the immense pressure you must be under, with the danger from your enemies and the loss of Ruprecht and Jordan, it might be that something got out of hand. His face softened. I only want to help, if you'll let me. The hard voice, the voice of Ceramite, had seemed to her to be like a different person the first time she'd heard him use it. Now looking into his eyes, she realised it was still the voice of Henrik, the voice of her blood. She wanted to ask him if he was asking as her brother or as an arbitrator. But in full truth, she was afraid of what the answer might be. If she were to allay his suspicions, she would need to do it quickly. Ashiel knew the correct course. If she wanted to manipulate Henrik, she would need to offer him what he had been denied, the acceptance of his family.
Henrik, she said, throne of terror, how you must be hurting to say such things.
I had no idea you and Renata were so close. She softened her expression and relaxed her stance. Her empathy was a better shield against his distrust than outrage. His own posture relaxed, if only a little.
We weren't, I suppose, he said. But she was kinder to me than anyone else. She treated me like a human being, instead of a resource to be expended or an inconvenience to be dealt with.
I can't imagine how much her loss must pain you, said Ashiel. But I swear to you, I had nothing to do with her passing. Henrik stared at her for a long moment, as if weighing the truth in her words. No, not quite. Measuring her sincerity. Finally, he looked away. Very well, he said. Ashiel wished she could tell him everything. He would be shocked, certainly, maybe even offended, but the words choked in her throat. He was a servant of the Emperor. His devotion to the throne would come before his devotion to his family. Ruprecht had seen to that when he sent the boy into exile. Of all the many legacies Ruprecht Matkesson had left her, Hanrik's enmity was the one that Ashiel found herself cursing him for. Ashiel strode through the halls of Darkadin as fast as she was able without breaking into a sprint. She dared not even swear aloud lest Hanrik hear and have his suspicions heightened. She stowed her fear and anger and kept her face as still and resolute as one of the busts of governors passed studding the hallways. Only when she had reached her own rooms and slumped into the spindle chair in front of her vanity did she allow herself a hiss of fury.
"Does something perturb?"
When Ashiel looked up, she could see the two pinpricks of hell fire near the gauzy shadows of her curtains. The curling purple runes suddenly filled her with a dread they had not before. When she had first seen Jezubiel, imprisoned in its oubliette, it had been terrifying, yes. But that had been the terror of the profane. No matter its origin, it was an affront to humanity, fit only to be purged by the Inquisition. The killing of Lostrovsky, too, had been horrifying, but again the shock was mundane and classifiable. It had been the brutal attack of a wild animal, a shocking and feral act to be sure, but no worse than what might have been if a marsh lion had got hold of the assassin. The murder of Tanzek had been something else entirely. There had been a level of astonishing savagery there that was beyond comprehension. At the same time, she had recognised the intricacy of the braided flesh, the deliberateness of the posing. Not just the staging, but the murder itself had been carried out with a malign sophistication that boggled the mind. "What a foul and wretched thing you are," she said into the mirror.
"Thank you," said Jezubiel. "Your own capacity for cruelty surprises me, too."
Ashiel turned in her chair.
"Don't lump me in with you, creature."
She cut herself short. Drawing the attention of the household was the last thing she wanted. She had no doubt the shadow thing would vanish the moment the door opened, leaving her staff to suspect her sanity was floundering.
"I'm nothing like you."
"Aren't you?"
The curtains ruffled, and Jezubiel was across the room, staring at her small bookshelf.
"The night you commanded me to slay the princeling, you had a palace full of enemies. Every house that wished you ill had set representatives to pledge their false loyalty to you. You could have seized any of them."
Jezubiel turned from the bookcase, a slim volume of art history in its clawed hands. It gave her a savage grin, tiny teeth shining in the darkness.
"You could have taken one of the servants or soldiers of your foes. But when you had to make a sacrifice to our pact, it wasn't the blood and flesh of your enemies you reached for, nor even for a soldier pledged to your service. Your hands reached first and instinctively to a trusted retainer, a woman who had given you a mother's care and devotion."
"Don't distort my actions,"
Ashiel said, stabbing an accusing finger at the monster.
"And don't try to interpret them through your own base and twisted lens. I didn't revel in her suffering. I ended it."
Jezubiel chuffed its clicking laugh.
"You can lie to your reflection, old lady, but you cannot lie to me."
Ashiel sneered.